the headlines this hour. Tehran slams the International Atomic Energy Agency after it raises concerns over what it calls covert changes to equipment at Iran's Fordo uranium enrichment plant. Israeli forces raid the Kabat Jaber refugee camp as part of intensified Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. And deepening political crisis in Peru, Congress rejects another bill by the president to advance elections to quell weeks' unrest. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Iran has denounced the UN nuclear watchdog over its Wednesday report that has raised concerns over changes to equipment at a nuclear site. Iran's nuclear chief, Mohammad Islami, says the IAEA report is based on a mistake by an inspector during a visit to the Fordo plant. Tehran has written to the agency explaining the inspector's mistake, but the agency publicized the issue. The Iranian official criticized the agency's behavior as unprofessional and unacceptable. Islami has warned that such practices would harm IAEA's reputation. The U.S. and its European allies have issued a joint statement accusing Iran of being inconsistent with its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They have found Tehran's response to the agency inadequate. Tehran says a comprehensive cooperation agreement between Iran and Venezuela is a turning point in relations between the two countries. Iran's Prime Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who is visiting Caracas, made the remarks during a meeting with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Amir Abdollahian said implementation of bilateral deals with Caracas would boost ties further. Maduro, for his part, said the experience of the two countries in dealing with shared issues necessitates strengthening relations. The two sides also stressed the need to stand up against foreign pressure and to defend their national interests. Amir Abdollahian earlier held talks with Venezuela's Vice President, among other top officials, and discuss ways to strengthen ties in different fields. 13 Palestinians have been injured in the Akabat Jaber camp in the occupied West Bank, where Israeli forces have surrounded a Palestinian home. The regime soldiers have reportedly stormed the camp with heavy machinery. Our correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more details.
For the sixth consecutive day, Israeli forces had been imposing a curfew or a closure on the Akbet Jaber refugee camp in Ariha because the Israelis claim that a Palestinian opened fire at a, let's say, an Israeli restaurant in or near a illegal settlement built in Ariha. The Israelis claim that this Palestinian who opened fire is originally from Akbet Jaber refugee camp. Every day, Israeli forces raid Akbet Jaber and prevent Palestinians to move freely. But what's happening since the early hours of this morning is that Israeli forces raided Akbet Jaber, surrounded a house there. They claim that the Palestinian who opened fire at a restaurant is from Akbet Jaber, and they are ordering his father and brothers to hand their son to the Israeli forces. As we are receiving now, all the entrances of Ariha and the main roads leading to Ariha, not only Akbet Jaber, are completely closed. Israeli forces are not allowing anyone to enter or to leave the area. Three Palestinians had been wounded during this operation. And it seems that the Israeli forces insist to arrest this Palestinian before leaving Akbet Jaber and Ariha.
China has accused U.S. media and politicians of using the recent balloon incident as a pretext to launch a smear campaign against Beijing. The Chinese Foreign Ministry issued a statement after the U.S. Secretary of State canceled a planned trip to the country over allegations that Beijing flew a spy balloon over the U.S. China had already expressed regret over the issue, blaming winds for pushing what it called a civilian airship into U.S. airspace. On Saturday, China further said that it never violated the territory and airspace of any sovereign nation. The ministry also emphasized the need for maintaining communication channels at all levels to deal with some unexpected situations. Antony Blinken issued a personal note to his Chinese counterpart after the discovery of the balloon over the U.S. state of Montana.
In my call today with Director Wang Yi, I made clear that the presence of this surveillance balloon in U.S. airspace is a clear violation of U.S. sovereignty and international law, that it's an irresponsible act, and that the PRC's decision to take this action on the eve of my planned visit is detrimental to the substantive discussions that we were prepared to have.
Blinken further said that the U.S. remains committed to diplomatic engagement with China and that he would make a trip to Beijing once conditions are favorable. In the meantime, the Pentagon said it had spotted a second similar balloon flying over Latin America. Beijing had already denied the U.S. accusation of spying. It said the balloon was used for meteorological purposes and had unintentionally escaped into U.S. airspace. Peru's Congress remains divided over President Dina Boluarte's bid to advance the general elections. Boluarte moved the proposal in an attempt to end the unrest that sparked after she assumed office about 2 months ago. Protesters in Peru are demanding her resignation in addition to early elections and constitutional reforms.
The political crisis deepens in Peru, where the legislative body has rejected President Dina Boluarte's bid to move elections to this year. Congress shelved the bill due to objections raised in a meeting of the Constitutional Committee on Friday. The matter is unlikely to be discussed before July when Congress begins its new session. Lawmakers had previously agreed to move the date of the elections from 2026 to April 2024, but it could not calm the protesters. Boluarte thinks the reschedule of the voting to this year might help mitigate unrest and chaos. The South American country has been in the grip of unrest since early December. There have been frequent clashes between protesters and police in several cities, almost on a daily basis. Confrontations have resulted in dozens of deaths. Apart from early elections, Peruvian protesters also demand President Boluarte step down.
We are outraged by the injustice that is happening, by the police repression, by the deaths, by the lack of justice. Also because the people are demanding the resignation of the president.
However, Boluarte has defied the calls accusing those demanding her resignation of pursuing political blackmail.
My resignation is not at stake in this situation. There is a minority of the population, of these groups that are generating violence and chaos in the country, who are pushing for my resignation in a blackmailing manner. And we are not going to give in to this political blackmail.
The protests have also taken a heavy toll on the country's economy, with workers being hit hard. The unrest has negatively affected transport of goods and the operation at key mines, which are major sources of income for the Andean nation. The protesters around the country have blocked highways, causing shortages of food, fuel, and other essentials in several regions. Hundreds of trucks remain stranded at the border with Bolivia, awaiting the end of a strike called by the protesters.
We are suffering every day. There's nothing to eat. Look how the roads are. You can't even walk, no motorcycle, no car, nothing. Dina Boluarte's government do not pay attention to what the people are demanding. What more do they want? How many more deaths?
Peru's unrest has been propelled mainly by indigenous people from the south. That's where ousted President Pedro Castillo comes from. He was removed from office and arrested in early December as he was attempting to shatter Congress to stave off his impeachment. The demonstrators demand his release because they regard Castillo as the one who can fight poverty and inequality. It seems that the fundamental problems driving the unrest will not go away, as the protesters are not only angry over stark inequality, but they feel neglected by state institutions, especially Congress, which many Peruvians say are being run by corrupt lobbies and vested interests.
Almost a year into the Russia-Ukraine war, there is not much hope that the two sides would end up at the negotiating table anytime soon. The West keeps supplying Kiev with heavy weapons, while Moscow says it will do anything to emerge victorious in the war. We discuss that further in our news review program.
The EU Commission chief says there is no rigid timeline for Kiev's accession to the European Union.
There are no rigid timelines, but there are goals that you have to reach. Reforms, for example, to improve a situation in the candidate country to then reach the accession negotiations and the accession itself.
Ursula von der Leyen praised Kiev's determination to meet EU recommendations despite being at war with Russia. Elsewhere in her remarks, the EU Commission chief said a new package of sanctions against Moscow is on its way to make Russia pay for its actions in Ukraine. She said technology will be targeted in the fresh sanctions to curb Russia's ability to produce drones. Meanwhile, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky urged the EU to accelerate its arms supply to Kiev.
If weapons are accelerated, namely long-range weapons, we will not only not withdraw from Bakhmut, we will begin to deoccupy Donbas, which has been occupied since 2014.
Zelensky also said Kiev will not surrender Bakhmut and will fight as long as it can. This comes as Kiev's Western allies pledge more weapons, mainly sophisticated and long-range arms, to Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly warned the West's military support for Ukraine will only prolong the war and increase the suffering of its people. This as Russia ramps up pressure on Ukrainian forces in eastern battlegrounds and also in the northeast and the south. Joining us for more on that is Johnny Miller, our correspondent in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk, and also Greg Simmons, author and researcher from Uppsala, Sweden. Gentlemen, welcome, Johnny. So can the delivery of these weapons effectively help the Ukrainian forces advance on the battleground, on the battlefield that's been under the spotlight recently?
Well, at the moment, that seems very unlikely. Even the New York Times recently released a post, an article saying that it will take months for these tanks and new weapons to reach the front line, whereas at the moment, Russia is launching huge offensives across Donbass. They're trying to take Bakhmut, Ublodar, heavily dug-in positions. The Ukrainians are putting up a very stiff resistance, but it looks like the Russians at some point will take these towns. There's also an expectation that Russia may well launch a massive offensive in the coming weeks or months, and it's unlikely these weapons will be able to get there in time to stop that Russian offensive. So at the moment, this conflict can go two ways. For Russia, this is an existential war. They can mobilize huge amounts of men and military hardware, parts of their economy. They see it as an existential war. Whereas NATO and Ukraine at one point will have to at some point enter negotiations. We're already seeing some parts of NATO start to question whether continuing to support and supply Ukraine is in fact a losing battle. But still, the pro-war camp led by the likes of Boris Johnson seems to be winning out. And the other way this can go is continued escalation and, of course, the very real risk of the official beginning of World War III.
So, Greg, membership of the European Union, membership of NATO, how will that exactly help the Ukrainians suffering on the ground, who are essentially calling for peace instead of war? The EU itself is suffering from an energy crisis and rising record inflation levels.
Yeah, well, I mean, you hear it's very bureaucrat speak, because we have goals but we don't have a timeline. And I mean, if we look at that in the wider context, I mean, this is similar to what they've been saying to Turkey about EU membership for how many decades. This means that there is no intention, but they're just drawing them along with this carrot, keeping fighting and dying for the US empire, because this is what they're trying to do. Keep them on the hook, so they keep on fighting and dying. This is what all of the US politicians are saying. That this is, I mean, they're all saying it between the lines, and some of them say it directly. Keep Ukraine armed and supplied, they'll fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. I mean, this is what this is part of. These so-called carrots to join this Euro-Atlantic sphere. And, I mean, it's just not feasible. I mean, the EU, as you know, I mean, it's suffering all these kinds of crises. And Ukraine is an utterly corrupt and dysfunctional country, which would make all of the other ones look fine and functioning. I mean, look at the effects East Germany had on West Germany by integrating something that was functioning. It doesn't make sense in practical terms.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your contribution. Let me thank our guest. Johnny Miller is our correspondent in the Eastern Donetsk region of Ukraine. Greg Simmons is an author and researcher joining us from Uppsala, Sweden. And that brings an end to another edition of the News Review.
A senior Russian official warned that the supply of more advanced U.S. weaponry to Ukraine would just add fuel to the fire, culminating in more retaliatory strikes from Russia. The deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, says in case Ukraine receives new weaponry, all regions remaining under its rule will also burn. He added that the use of longer-range weapons by Ukraine and its allies won't force Russia to hold negotiations. Medvedev emphasized that Russia is ready to use all types of weapons in accordance with their doctrinal documents. The Pentagon announced on Friday that it was sending Ukraine a new military package worth $2 billion. Russia has time and again reiterated that more military aid to Kiev would only prolong the war and add to the suffering of Ukrainians. Sri Lanka marks its 75 years of independence, celebrating the end of British colonial 48. A military parade was held in the capital, Colombo, to commemorate the occasion that was attended by top officials, including its president. During a speech, the president called on the nation to reflect on past errors and to rectify failures. The ceremony was boycotted by opposition parties while activists expressed anger at what they called a waste of money at a time of severe economic crisis. The island nation has been the scene of widespread protests triggered by an economic crisis last year. The protest movement peaked in July when people stormed the home of the former president for him to flee the country. The protesters then blamed the government for his worst economic crisis since its independence. Sri Lanka is still coping with the shortage of essentials. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Islamic Revolution and Economic Achievements. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, these days mark the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. In order to have a proper picture of the economic achievements of the Islamic Revolution, we should have a look at the waning days of the Pahlavi rule in Iran. During the Shah regime, Iran's economy was excessively dependent on oil exports. Millions of oil barrels were exported every day, while a huge amount of consumer goods worth hundreds of millions of dollars were imported to the country. During the last decade of the Shah reign, oil price enjoyed an unprecedented rise so that in 1977, the oil revenues reached over 20 billion of dollars, whereas this number never amounted to $1 billion in the decade before. American writer Francis Fitzgerald wrote that the Shah did not make serious effort for the development of the country. The country's wealth had been funneled mostly toward personal cars rather than buses, consumer goods rather than public health, and the salaries of soldiers and police rather than teachers. It can be said on the economy of 1970s in Iran that the regime's programs destroyed the economic balance of the country due to being far from the realities of society. As the Iranian economy was highly dependent on oil, the 1976-78 reduction of oil prices caused the government to borrow money, which in turn resulted in a bunch of problems, such as the shortage of skillful manpower, shortage of communicative networks like roads and ports, shortage of electricity, escape of capitals from the country, inflation, unemployment, housing, and so on. Unjust distribution of income in rural and urban regions and different strata of people caused remarkable class gap in society. Andrew Duncan, author of the book Looting Iran, Assault Towards Money, says that Iran's economy highly suffered from the ambitious and unwise plans of the Shah and his lack of information in the Iranian society. He writes that the Shah thought that money can solve every problem. He summoned the members of his cabinet on one day in August 1974 and announced that he wanted to double the 1973-78 development program. It meant to increase it from $35.5 billion to $86.8 billion. Although there were few specialists to implement such a huge plan, it would make no difference for the Shah. He would announce, for instance, that all children should go to school while forgetting that it needed at least 30,000 teachers. The Shah Prime Minister Hoveyda said in response to this great shortage, "No problem, we will teach all via TV." He had forgotten that over 65,000 villagers had no power grid at all. The victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in February 1979 revived hopes in the hearts of people. In spite of unprecedented pressures of enemies to obstruct or at least slow down the move of the revolution towards lofty ideals, including the 8-year imposed war, innumerable conspiracies inside and outside the country, and also imposition of the cruelest illegal sanctions on every aspect of the country's economy, the Islamic Republic has marched proudly in the course of growth and development. Justice enjoys a very outstanding position in Islam. According to the Quran, the aim of mission of all prophets has been to establish justice in society.
Imam Ali Pissapanhim says that cities and countries will not be developed except by justice. In view of this, among the most important goals of the officials in three branches of governance has been to provide welfare for people and provide them justice in various economic fields. Before the revolution, few villages enjoyed electricity, hygiene, water, natural gas, and telephone. This was common even among small cities and towns. Less than 12% of the rural areas had access to water grid, while this figure has surpassed 82%. There was 0 kilometer of water transferring line before the revolution, whereas the figure has reached almost 31 kilometers after the revolution. Qadir project in Khuzestan province has recently been exploited. The project is said to be the greatest in West Asia, and it will transfer drinking water to 26 cities and over 1,600 villages. The project has been implemented by Khatam al-Anbiya Construction Base, whose young experts have managed to finish the project within 8 months, while it was predicted to end in 36 months. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been successful in the field of dam construction. The number of dams in the country has increased tenfold compared with the pre-revolution era. In other words, nearly 200 dams have been built in Iran by a skillful young specialist. Dams are useful in various domains, including the production of hydroelectric energy. Iran is among the 10 top nations in the construction of power plants. This has caused 100% of the population in the cities and approximately 99.6% of the rural people to enjoy electricity. This, while the average electricity access among villages and cities in the world is 79 and 96% respectively. Another success in Iran in the field of energy is the construction of petrochemical factories and refineries. Over 70% of Iran's energy consumption relies on natural gas. Currently, more than 98% of cities and 84% of villages are connected to the natural gas grid. There are nearly 2,000 active oil companies in the country. Before the revolution, the major part of this industry was run by foreign firms, but today Iranian experts have succeeded to indigenize 80% of the equipment needed in the field. The great bulk of this equipment is high-tech. 50 of the manufacturing companies are in the international rank and export some of their products, like catalysts, to Russia. Iran seriously tries to increase the number of petrochemical factories and refineries to prevent crude sale. Today, the number of active petrochemical complexes has increased to 68, more than tenfold the period before the revolution. Between 90 to 100 million liters of gasoline is averagely produced every day in the country. This includes 27% of Iran's refinery basket, which is higher than the global average.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I would like to begin by extending best wishes to you on this very important celebration in our calendar, the birth anniversary of our first Imam, the brother of the Prophet, husband of Fatima, and the father of Hassanain, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wasalam. When it comes to Ali, the issue is not that where will we find issues and topics and themes to talk about him. When it comes to Ali, the issue is, what do you don't say? Because there is quite a lot. You can have a multi-volume book on Amir al-Mu'mineen. You can have sessions after sessions talking about Amir al-Mu'mineen. But let me go to his very famous title, Amir al-Mu'mineen. Sometimes when we use this term, Amir al-Mu'mineen, we just have this concept in mind. Yes, there are thousands and millions of mu'mineen around the world, and Ali is the Amir of that group. We have to realize he is not only the chief or the leader of the mu'mineen globally. Rather, when it comes to Muslims, if you really want to see the measure by which you can say this Muslim has iman or not, you will have to see whether he loves Ali or not. In a statement by Amir al-Mu'mineen, quoted by Sunni authorities, Imam Nasai in Khasais Amir al-Mu'mineen, Nasai is one of those authors who had written this book on hadith, and he has a special book dedicated to Khasais Amir al-Mu'mineen, means the special qualities of Ali ibn Abi Talib. He, as well as Muslim in Sahih Muslim and many other books of Ahl al-Sunnah wal-Jama'ah, they actually have a quotation from Amir al-Mu'mineen where he says, by Allah, the one in his hand is my soul. The Prophet has told me very clearly that, O Ali, none shall love you but a mu'min. Look at the way the words have come. La yuhibbuka illa mu'minun. No one shall love you but somebody who is a mu'min. And nobody will hate you but that he is a munafiq and a hypocrite. So when it comes to the issue of Ali, Ali becomes the standard and the measure for iman and nifaq. Those who love Ali, they have iman. Those who hate Ali, they actually are on the path of nifaq and hypocrisy. Even the celebration that we have for his birth anniversary, the birth itself was a very extraordinary event. Because if you look at Amir al-Mu'mineen, there is a term used by the Sufi masters where they say Ali was a spiritual being in the material world. You see, he doesn't belong to this world. He is from the spiritual world. He has manifested here in that way. And if you really want to see that concept in one way, Ali is somebody who was born inside the Kaaba, Masjid al-Haram in Mecca. And we know that he was killed inside Masjid al-Nabi in Kufa. He spent many, many years in Medina, in a place where his house was in a way part of Masjid al-Nabi. Born in Masjid al-Haram, killed in Masjid al-Kufa, lived for many, many years in Medina in Masjid al-Nabi. What can you say about him? Even if you look at the places, Masjid al-Haram, Masjid al-Nabi, Masjid al-Kufa, these are the most sacred masajid according to our fiqh. Salawat parane ek par aur. When we talk about the birth of Ali, and I would like to focus tonight on the Kaaba itself, in relation to Ali, these were similarities between Ali and the Kaaba. But now we come to one important difference. When it comes to Kaaba and Hajj, it is wajib on all Muslims. Quran says that, you know, the Hajj is wajib. Man istata'a ilayhi sabila. Istita'at. Anyone who has the capability, health-wise, wealth-wise, has the money to go, then it is wajib. So it's not wajib on all Muslims. Only those Muslims have the financial and health capability to travel to for Hajj, it is wajib on them. Otherwise, it is not wajib. But when it comes to the law for wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there are no conditions there. No excuses there at all. Sayyid Radhi, in one of his books known as Khasais Amir al-Mu'mineen, is a narration going all the way to the 11th Imam, you know, his sanad, and then from 11th Imam to Rasulullah, where he says, Ya Ali, mathalukum finnas, mathalu safinati nuh. Your example, Ali, among the people is like the Ark of Nuh. Man rakibaha naja, whoever embarks on it, they will be saved. وَمَنْ تَخَلَّفَ عَنْهَا غَرَقَ. Whoever abandons it, they will perish. مَنْ أَحَبَّكُمْ يَا عَلِي نَجَى وَمَنْ أَبْغَضُكُمْ وَرَفَضَ مُحَبَّتُكُمْ هَوَى فِي النَّارِ. Whoever loves you will be saved. Whoever hates you will go into Jahannam. And then the Prophet comes to the Kaaba. وَمَثَلُكُمْ يَا عَلِي مَثَلُ بَيْتِ اللَّهِ الْحَرَامِ. The example of Ali, you is like the Baytullah, the Kaaba. Man dakhalahu, you know the whole Baytullah there. Whoever enters that area, it's a sanctuary. He is secured. Nobody can do anything to him. Even according to Islamic laws, even if a criminal runs away from the police and goes into Masjid al-Haram, they can't go after him. They can ask the people not to give him food and drink, although he will still survive on Zamzam there. But they can create an environment that he is forced to come out, then they will arrest him. And that is the irony. You know, when we talk about Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that they even plan to kill him by the Kaaba itself. Whereas Quran says very clearly, Man dakhlahu kana aminan. Whoever areas goes to that area, it's a sanctuary, and they will be safe. And so the Prophet relates that to Ali, that whoever loves Ali, they will be protected from the azab of the hereafter. And then we come to the main point. Ya Ali. وَلِلَّهِ عَلَى النَّاسِ حِجُّ الْبَيْتِ مَنْ اسْتَطَاعَ عَلَيْهِ سَبِيلًا. O Ali, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran says that it is a duty for people, for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to visit the Kaaba. But who? Man istata'a ilayhi sabila. Whoever has the means to go to the Kaaba. فَمَنْ كَانَ لَهُ عُزْرٌ فَلَهُ عُزْرٌ. If somebody has an excuse, he can't go because of, let's say, the political circumstances of his own country, then his excuse will be accepted. مَنْ كَانَ فَقِيرًا فَلَهُ عُزْرٌ. If somebody is poor, cannot afford to go to Mecca for Hajj, he is excused. وَمَنْ كَانَ مَرِيضًا فَلَهُ عُزْرٌ. The Prophet says, whoever not feeling well, health-wise, is not capable of traveling, he will be excused from going from to Hajj. But what about the wilayat of Ali? Wallahi la yu'udhar. There is no excuse when it comes to your wilayat. Ghaniyan wala faqiran. Doesn't matter you are rich or poor, maridhan aw sahihan. You are in health or illness or sickness. La a'ma wala basir. Whether you can see, you are blind, or you have sight, doesn't matter. In all cases, you must have the vilayat and law of Ali ibn Abi Talib. So there is no excuse when it comes to vilayat of Ali, the devotion to Ali, and the law for Ali ibn Abi Talib.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. this program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Many farm workers in the U.S. are still out of work and struggling to afford food in the wake of California's disastrous floods. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. In this regard, workers in California who grow and pick the majority of fruits and nuts in the United States are experiencing an acute crisis of on- and underemployment and ensuing food insecurity following the procession of atmospheric rivers that drenched the state in January. In a mere matter of days, many locations across the Golan Estate absorb the upwards of half the precipitation that tends to fall over the course of an entire year. Over 32 trillion gallons between December 25th and January 20th. Amid record drought conditions, soils shifted from scorched to soaked overnight, leading to hundreds of landslides, cars swept away by floodwaters, and at least 22 deaths. Farm owners are now tallying the damage to apply for federal disaster assistance, and amid the welcome sunshine, public discourse has turned to silver linings like the Fuller Reservoir and how the rainfall was great for agriculture. But the people at the heart of the fruit basket of the U.S., over three-quarters of nuts and fruits and one-third of vegetables consumed in the U.S. are grown in California. Farm workers have weathered long stretches without work or with significantly fewer hours, making it all but impossible to feed their own families. Julia Horta, a single mother of four who has lived in Oxnard, California for 10 years, felt the impact of the storms in December. Horta, who works growing blackberries and strawberries, made $200 per week that month, with fewer hours available due to wet conditions. It wasn't nearly enough to cover all of her expenses. Her rent alone is $2,000 per month, though she was able to feed herself and her children, who are 6, 10, 12, and 13 years old. She didn't work a single day in January because the fields were oozing with water and mud. Horta told Truthout, "It's really difficult to support my kids right now." When asked what she would like to see elected officials do to support farm workers like her who remain out of work or with lost hours, the first thing Horta listed and swiftly was migration reform, adding also help paying rent and food. Global warming caused primarily by the burning of fossil fuels is altering the behavior of atmospheric rivers, the vast aerial tides of water vapor thousands of miles long and hundreds wide that drive the majority of precipitation on the U.S. West Coast. As atmospheric rivers warm and widen, they are projected to produce winter storms dumping up to 40% more water by mid-century. The extremes have gave implications for the food system. In 2022, irrigated cropland in California shrank 752,000 acres when compared with 2019, due mostly to drought. Floodwaters are presenting a new layer of complications. Consumers who were already experiencing rising prices linked with extreme weather are now taking a hit for the January storms. As Andrew Stevens, assistant professor of agriculture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, told WEAU News. According to Stevens' projections, prices for produce like lettuce are likely to continue rising over the next few weeks due to a shortage in supply, though he expects the ripple effect will be short-term. Farm owners and other impacted agricultural operations are estimated to have absorbed millions in damages to livestock, crops, and infrastructure. But short of social reforms that take a stock of how climate change will heighten personal insecurity for the most vulnerable, perhaps no one stands to be more intimately impacted than the state's 500,000 to 800,000 farm workers, an estimated half of whom are undocumented and, under existing laws, do not qualify for unemployment or any other benefits. Even when hours are available, farm workers in the U.S. earn an average of $14,000 annually, As Prism has reported, in spite of the complex skills required, that level of compensation does not leave workers with much potential for savings. Workers like Horta currently rely on support from food distribution events or effects like private campaigns. But anecdotally, thousands were still without work the last week of January, according to the United Farm Workers, UFW Communications Director Antonio De Lorella Brost, who noted that if studied comprehensively, that figure would likely be much higher, somewhere in the tens of thousands. Al Jazeera English also noted, California's agricultural workforce has long struggled with low wages and vulnerability stemming from immigration status. A mass shooting that killed 7 farm workers in the United States last week has brought renewed attention to the hardships faced by agricultural workers in the state of California, stretched thin by low wages and the high cost of living. The shooting on January 23 took place in the coastal community of Half Moon Bay, a small coastal town about 40 kilometers south of San Francisco in Northern California.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enemies engineered Iran's unrest meticulously, but failed due to wrong calculations. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of eulogists and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya. On January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Aliha. I'd like to say just a few words about the subject of elegies today. Elegies are a part of our heritage. It is the heritage of the Shia. Yes, we do not know whether Kumayt, Da'bil, and Sayyid al-Himyari, for example, recited their elegies with melodies or not, but they would write and recite poetry and circulate the teachings of the Prophet's household. You elegists have come and turned this into a complex art. Today's elegies and eulogies are a form of hybrid art. It is art. Or in other words, it is beautiful. Art is something beautiful after all. It is both beautiful and it creates beauty. You have combined several arts together, the sum of which results in an elegy or a eulogy.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A good voice, this is the first. The next art is good poetry, that's the second. And a good melody, that's the third one. Of course, each one of these has certain characteristics, conditions, and limits, some of which I will address. In addition, you need a good theme and a good content. Because having a good poem is one thing, but it is another thing to have good content. A poem may be very good, but it may lack rich content. Or it might not have the right content. There might be a problem with the content. We have these sorts of poems, in addition to very good poems, where the poetry is good, but the content has flaws. I have written down a poem by Sa'ib Tabrizi, so that I can read it for you. He said, "Even if you tell me, you shall not see me, I'll not despair like Moses did. When Allah turned to Prophet Moses and said, 'You shall not see me,' Prophet Moses let it go, but in this poem he says, 'I will not despair.' Even if you tell me, 'You shall not see me,' I will not despair like Moses did. I know the sweet language of my love.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. Guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.